Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Minimal tech doom and gloom content today, a departure from recent standards. What's not a departure from standards? Two guests, two segments. With Zoran Mamdani in the news, the historian Gabriel Hetland will look to Latin America for models of municipal socialism. And then the philosopher Lea Uppi will talk about her new book, an investigation of her family's past in and around Albania. We in New York are very excited about our mayor-elect, Zoran Mamdani. Well, not everyone, of course. Wall Street and the so-called real estate community aren't, nor are bigots, yahoos, and other political reactionaries. Zoran's emphasis on affordability in this very expensive city was key to his success, but contrary to the advice of some class-first types, he did so while also emphasizing what are sometimes disparaged as identity issues, like immigrant and trans rights. Mamdani's victory, a side benefit of which was the humiliation of the odious Andrew Cuomo, was made possible by a huge political mobilization led by the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, who organized 100,000 volunteers, who knocked on 2 million doors, and transformed him from someone who got 1% in the early polls to someone who got more votes and turned out more voters than any other mayoral candidate in over 50 years. He is a phenomenal political figure, smart and charismatic, but he wouldn't have gotten past that 1% without that organization. New York City DSA, an organization of which I should say I'm a member, has done extraordinary work in changing the political landscape of this city. But what next? Zoran has faced deep and dishonest hostility from those reactionaries and bigots, and it's only going to get worse. There might be some lessons to be learned about how to conduct a socialist mayoralty in the face of bourgeois enmity from Latin America. Here with more is Gabriel Hetland, who studied the matter in Venezuela. Gabriel is an associate professor of Latin American history at the University of Albany. His full formal department name reads like a souvenir of a different time, Department of Africana, Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx Studies. Gabriel speaks of clientelism, a term we don't define. It describes a political system in which patronage matters a lot. Jobs and resources are given to supporters on the basis of loyalty rather than on the basis of merit or need demonstrated openly and fairly. In the U.S., it characterizes the old urban political machines, as well as Donald Trump's style of governance. Gabriel Hetland. You look at Torres, a city in Venezuela, as an example of municipal socialism under the mayoralty of Julio Chavez that Zoran and company can learn from. Who is Chavez? No relation to Hugo, I presume. And how did he come to power?
Yeah, so Julio Chavez was the mayor of Torres, which is a sort of mid-sized municipality in western Venezuela in the state of Lara. So Julio was a student leader growing up. He did some union activism. He was a pretty radical guy, a Marxist, a democratic socialist. And he ran for mayor in 2000 on this sort of far-left party called Patria para Todos, or Fatherland for All. He lost by a huge amount and then ran again in 2004. This is at the start of the so-called Bolivarian Revolution, which Hugo Chavez led. But Julio Chavez was not part of that. He was running to the left of that. And in 2004, he ran against two much more sort of formidable candidates, one backed by the ruling party of Hugo Chavez, the Fifth Republic Movement, and another backed by the conservative opposition, the incumbent mayor, who actually had previously been part of the Fifth Republic Movement. And surprisingly, Julio Chavez, with support of peasant movements, social movements from around Torres municipality, won a squeaker of a three-way election, became mayor, and promised to sort of give all power to the people. And, you know, really proceeded to do that over the next 4 years. And then his successor continued that for a number of years afterwards.
Hugo Chavez's idea was based in part on building participation at the grassroots, or, and not just a kind of top-down old-style model, or at least professedly so. But Julio Chavez didn't get along so well with Hugo. What was that relationship like?
So he did get along with Hugo Chavez, but he didn't get along with the party of Hugo Chavez. It's sort of a complicated story. But Hugo Chavez, you know, talked about participatory democracy. Participatory and protagonistic democracy was part of the 1999 Bolivarian Constitution, which was supported by a supermajority of Venezuelans. And the Fifth Republic Movement, Hugo Chavez's party, was supposed to implement that, but as many scholars have shown, it turned into something more like participatory clientelism, where you had some sort of participatory institutions getting funneled into more clientelistic distribution of resources. And Hugo Chavez's party, you know, supported all sorts of people, kind of like, you know, the Democrats as well, some of whom were pretty good, some of whom were really corrupt and not great. And so Julio Chavez identified as Bolivarian, identified as Chavista, but was from a party that wasn't the official ruling party in the beginning. Later on, he actually joined Hugo Chavez's party and, you know, he was put on a presidential commission. So his relationship with the president actually was pretty decent, but party leaders tried to thwart him when he was mayor of Torres. So in his first 2 years of office, they established what people call a parallel city hall, where they funneled money to other city councilors who were opposed to Julio Chavez, the mayor. And they really tried to block his agenda. And the way he mobilized his supporters, they like physically occupied City Hall on a number of occasions to overcome this elite obstruction to his agenda. I think that provides some interesting lessons for thinking about Zohran that, you know, we can get into.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Trump sends in the National Guard. A different story.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, I think that the picture that Mamdani as mayor will face is going to be different. It's going to be much more hostile than what Julio Chavez faced, but there's still elite opposition to a sort of participatory democratic, radically democratic socialist mayor was happening even in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. And so there's, you know, really fascinating dynamics to dig into there.
Okay, so core to Julio's idea, and I, as you say, he is universally known as Julio. I'm not just being informal. Core to his idea of socialism was constructing popular power. Now, it's interesting that he saw the need to construct it. There's no like popular power in chrysalis that could flourish if you remove obstacles to it. It needed to be constructed. So how did he go about doing that?
One of the main ways he did it was this, you know, really ambitious participatory budget, where they gave 100% of municipal investment funds to participatory councils that existed throughout the municipality of Torres. And when I say the investment portion, it meant not all of the budget. So, you know, it was like close to 40%, all of the new money that was going for new spending. So it wasn't the salaries and things like that. But there was 17 parishes, which are districts around Torres. And they had district assemblies, which had very sort of popular working class bases. We're talking like farm workers, low paid teachers, students, domestic caregivers, the unemployed showing up. And they had these robust deliberative discussions that I went to during my research for a book I wrote about this some years ago. And, you know, could see them talking about how to do the city, how to spend the money that the city had for different projects. And Julio Chavez was very supportive of this and even, you know, would say things in interviews like, the first year, something like 13% of the projects went to for evangelical churches. Julio Chavez was agnostic, was a Marxist, wasn't happy, but he couldn't veto that. So there was these really strong institutional mechanisms that were guaranteeing that there was real popular control. So that was the sort of basic big institution, but there was all sorts of other ways that the city went about trying to support this. One of them was this Office of Citizen Participation. And it was led by a former social movement leader, this guy Lalo Páez, who had been active for decades and decades. And, you know, he had links to guerrilla movements in the 60s and 70s. He had done all this cultural work. He was just a very, very committed social movement leader. And there were other social movement leaders throughout the administration. And that was a really important part of the success that Julio Chavez had. So Lalo Páez headed this Office of Citizenship Participation, and they went around Torres and they helped to organize, initially they call them communal boards or juntas comunales, and then later on communal councils, which was an institution and an organizational form that was spreading throughout Venezuela at the time. But in Torres, they really worked very, very hard to make sure that this was a politically pluralistic space, that there was no religious divisions within it. And they established in a relatively small, in terms of population, municipality, like 180,000, around 600 of these communal councils. And so these were the sort of building blocks of this popular power. They would meet on a regular basis to talk about community needs. They do participatory diagnoses to figure out what were the needs of particular neighborhoods and particular villages. It's a large, you know, rural municipality in many of its parts. And then they'd participate in the participatory budget as well. And so it was a very, very sort of participatory process. And I think a lesson that Mamdani, you know, would find useful, it was very successful institutionally. They really delivered on what they said they were going to do. And part of that was having ordinary citizens themselves building the projects. So more than like 75% of the projects were not just decided by ordinary citizens, but actually constructed by them, like physically. They would do the brickwork, they would, you know, lay the mortar, they would figure it all out. And that was a great thing in terms of accountability, in terms of having people who really knew the needs of their communities be part of the process, be leading the process. So it was just, you know, impressive in a lot of ways. And I think it also, you know, sort of went beyond just bread and butter. There was a vision of what they called autogobierno or self-governance. And so Lalo Pais talked about the people being the government. Julio Chavez had this vision of sort of a, you know, a true participatory socialism where it wasn't just giving people material benefits, but really actively having them learn how to govern themselves. And that, I think, is really the lesson for building popular power, that you have ordinary people talking to their neighbors and figuring out how to disagree, figuring out how to deliberate, figuring out how to make decisions that matter to their lives, live with the results of votes that may not go their way in these assemblies, and then implement those decisions and do it year after year and build the confidence, build the sort of sense that we can run this city, we can make it work for us.
I'm speaking with the historian of Latin America, Gabriel Hetland. Participatory budgeting in many cases has been just about allocating crumbs, but it sounds like the Julio version got more to the heart of the loaf.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. And there's, you know, great work by scholars like Giampaolo Beocci has a paper I love from 2014 called Participatory Budgeting as If Emancipation Mattered. And it gets to the heart of the question. It's a great title. It gets to the heart of the question about how participatory budgeting in a lot of places, including New York City, you know, it's been okay. It's been, you know, exciting in certain ways, but it's like park benches. If you walk through Prospect Park, you'll see some park benches that might say they came from participatory budgeting. It's really minor things that don't really matter to people's lives. Again, not to dismiss the significance of those things. I think they can be important, but in Latin American cities, in Porto Alegre, where it first started in the early 1990s under the leftist Workers' Party, before they took more of a centrist turn in recent years, and then in Torres in Venezuela, it was really important decisions, and it was major, major money. I mean, having the entirety, 100% of the municipal investment budget going to participatory budgeting, meaning that all of the spending that the city was doing on new projects had to be decided in these popular councils, in a participatory process. And so that's really different than having participatory budgeting going to crumb. So I think if we're thinking, you know, about Zoran Mamdani and how to do participation, I don't know that you have to copy sort of the model of Porto Alegre or Torres. You could in certain ways, but I think what really is essential is having it be decisions that matter to people's lives. What are the things that are most important to people's lives, and how can you have a larger degree of popular control over those decisions? And I think that's what's really crucial.
You touched on this a bit, but let's talk about it some more. How did he staff his administration? What kind of mix of, you know, political activists and technocrats was there?
There was a really impressive mix. So, you know, there was a lot of people who had degrees from very high quality universities within Venezuela. But there was lots of social movement leaders as well who were in his administration. And that, I think, was crucial to have both making sure you have really competent people who have high quality training, who know how to do engineering, who know how to do, you know, nuts and bolts accounting and budgeting. That's crucial. That's important. And they had that. But they had these social movement leaders who were occupying top positions. The chief of the Julio Chavez's staff was this guy for a while, Johnny Murphy, who was a anarchist exile from Argentina, a real character, and, you know, had decades of experience doing social movement organizing. Lalo Pais was another one who I mentioned in the Office of Citizenship Participation. Another guy, Chicho Medina, also had literally decades and decades of social movement organizing and experience. And I think that was important in a few different ways. One, it directly connected Julio Chavez's administration to popular movements. And I should mention Julio Chavez himself was a social movement leader before becoming mayor. So that, you know, it connected them to social movements. It meant that you had leaders in high posts within the administration who shared a vision of democratic socialism and deeply, deeply believed in it. I think that was a second really crucial factor. And then third, they knew how to do social movement organizing. And so when there was this pushback from the local oligarchy, so lots of landowners who were sort of part of the anti-Chavez, anti-ruling party opposition, and from the ruling party, which again was opposed to Julio Chavez for many of his years as mayor, when you had opposition to that, you had people in City Hall who knew how to mobilize, who knew how to do organizing, and who did that organizing in order to implement their agenda. And again, you link that with the competence, you link that with people with professional degrees and with, you know, real training, and you connected that to ordinary people who were the ones who most knew what their needs were and who were willing and able to sort of figure out how to best meet those needs.
Now, you mentioned his conflicts with the local landed oligarchs. Zohran's antagonists are members of the national and international ruling class. So the New York task seems like a bit of a heavier lift, but what can we learn from that experience of Julio?
One of the key lessons for the Torres experience that I think can translate in ways for New York City is if you encounter elite opposition to your agenda, which you will when you are on the left and which you will certainly when you're a democratic socialist, organizing a working and middle class base and mobilizing that working and middle class base actively is really important. And there's so many times that this happened in Torres where they were blocked by the city council and Julio Chavez would mobilize hundreds of people to occupy city council. The national government was hostile to some of the things that they were trying to do, and they would sort of block that. And he would mobilize his supporters against that. He tried to run for a primary election to be the governor of Laura State in 2008. The party, which he was part of at the time, Hugo Chavez's party, blocked him initially, and he mobilized people. And that succeeded in overcoming those obstacles. So that's one really important piece of it. The other thing that I talk a little bit about in this Jacobin piece that I recently wrote about this is that doing a sort of refraction of national discourse can be a very useful strategy. So by that, I mean just sort of taking elements of what the national ruling party is putting forward as its own project and repurposing them for your own ends. So to talk about Torres, and then I'll talk about how Zohran Mamdani has literally already done this. In Torres, Julio Chavez took a lot of discourse about popular power and participation and democratic socialism, which lots of Chavistas were talking about in Venezuela, but not really doing, not really implementing. And he put it into a very different sort of political institutional framework at the local level and made it real. He actually pushed for a sort of democratic socialism. He made very significant progress with part of a big movement towards participatory democracy and really built popular power. But utilizing that national discourse meant he could tap into a larger project and say, we are part of this larger project and we are fulfilling this larger project. And it was one that people understood. So now moving to Zohran Mamdani and the U.S. and what's going on now, Trump has talked about some things that Zohran Mamdani finds appealing, such as affordability and cost of living. He hasn't delivered in any way on that, of course. And Mamdani has really tapped into that and said, I hear those concerns and I'm going to deliver on what President Trump has failed to deliver on. I think that's a really smart strategy because you then sort of expose the hypocrisy of the national ruling party, but you also tap into some of the things that they have pointed to successfully as well.
Oh, and finally, the Julio era in Torres ran from 2005 to 2016. It ended 9 years ago. What's happened since?
Just to give a quick play-by, so Julio was a mayor from 2005 to 2008, and then his successor, Edgar Carrasco, took over as mayor after that, and he actually continued until a couple years ago, but it really frayed from 2016 on the sort of political crisis and the economic crisis within Venezuela, which was caused by a bunch of different factors, sort of hyperinflation, bad government policies, U.S. sanctions, that's a major one, meant that there was this incredible tension and a real difficulty in continuing that project. And so the opposition came back into office a couple of years ago within Torres. And as far as I know, a lot of the progress that had been made really reversed. But even before that, the situation from 2016 onwards was so difficult for Venezuelans that getting them to meaningfully participate in popular organizing was increasingly difficult. And with hyperinflation, doing any kind of budgeting was incredibly hard. So this was a great experiment. It really worked for a number of years. If the national context had been more stable longer, who knows how long it could have gone on. But ultimately, those sort of national contradictions, which again, the U.S. played a really huge role in making much worse and making those contradictions much tighter, ultimately it couldn't sustain itself. And so it sort of went away recently.
That was Gabriel Hetland, Associate Professor of Latin American History at the University of Albany. He's got an article on all this on the Jacobin website. I've been running a lot of analyses of our tech overlords and the dystopia they're creating for us lately. There's none of that in this week's interviews, but I needed a fix. Here's about a minute of the evil Peter Thiel from his June interview with Ross Douthat, revealing who the Antichrist, a favorite topic of his, is.
The way the Antichrist would take over the world is you talk about Armageddon nonstop. You talk about existential risk nonstop, and this is what you need to regulate. It's the opposite of the picture of Baconian science from the 17th, 18th century, where, you know, the Antichrist is like some evil tech genius, evil scientist who invents this machine to take over the world. People are way too scared for that. In our world, the thing that has political resonance is the opposite. The thing that has political resonance is we need to stop science. We need to just say stop to this. And this is where, yeah, I don't know. In the 17th century, I can imagine a Dr. Strangelove, Edward Teller type person taking over the world. In our world, it's far more likely to be Greta Thunberg.
Yes, that Greta, the one who wants to prevent climate disaster and risked her life to protest the massacre in Gaza. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break. That was a bit of Alexander Scriabin's Sonata No. 9, known as the Black Mass. Next, an investigation of a personal and historical past from the philosopher Leah Ypi, YPI. She was on this show a few years ago to talk about her book Free, a memoir of growing up in the last days of communist Albania and in the early days of its neoliberal successor. Now she's out with a new book, Indignity, A Life Reimagined, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's an investigation of her own family history and how it reflects the larger story of Albania and the Balkans. She's a professor of political theory at the London School of Economics. Leah Ypi. This all started with your discovery of a photograph. Tell that story, and where'd you go from there?
So I, at some point, received a text message from a relative who said, "Have you noticed that your grandmother has become viral on Facebook?" And so, sure enough, I went on Facebook and discovered a photo of her that I had never seen before, posted by someone I had never heard of before, followed by hundreds of derogatory comments of people who didn't know my grandmother, but who were alleging that she had been a communist spy, a fascist spy, sometimes both. The photograph was clearly taken during her honeymoon in the Italian Dolomites in the winter of 1941. And I had always wondered, my grandmother spoke often and fondly about those years, those weeks spent skiing in the Dolomites. And she said that this had been the happiest time of her life. And I had always wondered what sort of person can say that they were the happiest person in the world. in the winter of 1941, but there was nothing left to search and no records to chase, because I was also told that all records from my grandmother's youth disappeared when the communists arrested my grandfather in 1946 after World War II ended in Albania, confiscating all her photos as well. So it was the appearance of this photo combined with the mystery of where it came from, with the mystery of that time of her life, with the question raised by the anonymous users on Facebook commenting on her, that set me on a search to the Secret Service archives of communist Albania, where not just her photos, but all the records concerning my family's life during communism, my grandfather's trial, documents, her surveillance reports were supposed to be held. And that's how the book starts.
And you spend a lot of time at archives, Secret Service archives. But as you make clear, people might think that archives are maybe the last word on something, the truth, the secret hidden truth of affairs. But in fact, they're not all that definitive. They seem to be more places of contradiction, vagueness, false leads, and all kinds of frustrations. Is that right?
Yes, because in a number of societies that are in many ways traumatized by historical injustice, there is this what seems to me now somewhat naive belief that reconciliation will be obtained only once we find the facts of what happened to someone in this traumatic period, and that the archive contains the truth about those lives. But I think this only works if you can trust the mechanism from which the truth is transmitted. And that is not the case. In most archives, there is a power that shapes and orders the fact that the archive contains in a certain way. And not just in a communist archive, where one could read from the surveillance reports how communist ideology shaped the way they were writing about the people they were surveilling, how they were adding stuff sometimes just so they had something to report at the end of the day. Sometimes how the human element interfered, where people felt sympathetic for the objects that they were surveilling. They called them objects, those people. And sometimes they would omit information so as not to get them in trouble. But also in the other archives that I then went to continue the search of my grandmother's life in Greece, for example, where she was born in Thessaloniki in 1918, I discovered that records concerning the Ottoman period of the city are very scarce. And in many ways, the evidence that we have is the evidence that the Greek nation state wants us to have, and the story that it wants to tell about this, the life of this Ottoman city that then became a Greek city. For example, it's very difficult to search women in the archives because they weren't even juridical subjects until very recently. And so often it's much easier to search for the father, the husband, or the brother. So in the end, the book is as much about what you don't find in the archive, about the silence of the archive, about the manipulation, about the layers of propaganda that you find. And it raises the question of if you care about the dignity of someone who is not there anymore, like I cared about the dignity of my grandmother, and I wanted to make sure that I could tell the story of her life in a dignified way. Where do you go and how do you reconstruct this life in a way that isn't just repeating the story of the archive, but adding something, telling it from a more moral perspective, let's say.
A couple of years ago, I discovered that the Italian state has an archive on my grandfather, who was politically active in the early 20th century, involved in Mussolini's Socialist Party before he took a fascist turn. And they followed him for like 20, 30 years until he came to the U.S. and they lost track of him. But I thought maybe I should look into this archive and track some things down. But I got to say, reading your book made me think twice about doing that.
Yeah, there's certainly, I think one has to go prepared for the frustration. But I think it's certainly interesting and it's worth doing, not because one necessarily trusts the truth of the archive or trusts the facts, but because the archives also tells a different story, which is the story of power and authority and the way in which those authorities combine and put together the facts in a certain way. And so it's also its own creative enterprise that's very much worth studying, not so much, as I say, to find the truth of a life, but to reconstruct the broader forces that contribute to shaping these lives that are now in the past and that we can only have access in this fragmented way.
Now, the decades of your grandmother's youth, 20s and 30s, were very unstable. Lots of political agitation, a lot of political tensions. One of the things that struck me was the incredible ethnic and linguistic diversity of in and around Albania, population transfers and all kinds of things going on in, 23, 24. Tell that history of what exactly all these ethnic groups and their fractures, how they make Albania and shape Albania and the surrounding area.
Yeah, so my grandmother was born to an Albanian family, although she had never been to Albania until she was 18. She was born to an Albanian family that was linked to the Ottoman Empire, whose ancestors were high-ranking administrators under the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was a very multicultural, multilingual entity. And Salonika, which was the city where she was born and was a very important both diplomatic and trade center of the empire, was a city of cosmopolitan life, of many different linguistic and ethnic groups. The largest group in the city were actually not Greeks, but Sephardic Jews, and alongside them, Albanians, Bulgarians, Turks, Greeks. All of this came to an end first when Salonika was annexed or liberated by the Greek state, depending on whether you ask the Greeks or the Turks. And then when the Ottoman Empire collapsed alongside the Habsburg and the Russian empires, and those cosmopolitan entities had to break up into nation states because the new principle that organized political order at that point became the nation state principle. And this was very traumatic, very violent. I remember when I was a child, my grandmother would tell me about the violence of the population exchange. And as a child, I could hardly get my head around what is a population exchange. And what it was this forced removal of all the Greeks of Asia Minor, so in contemporary Turkey, their forced relocation to Greece. And all the Turks of Greece had to go to Turkey. And then the other communities within either of these cities and either of these states had to find the state to which that nation belonged. So if you were Albanian, you had to return to Albania. If you were Bulgarian, you had to return to Bulgaria. And as I say, this was a very traumatic time, in part because people had to go to places they'd never been before with which they had no links. Salonika went from being a cosmopolitan center to being a city of refugees. Over a million Greeks came from Asia Minor to the city. And with that, all the pressure on healthcare, jobs, housing. And this was also then a way in which those population movements, population displacement, fragmenting of culture became later scapegoated by the rise of nationalism and nationalist politicians that exploited identity and minority questions for their own purposes and to advance their own political interests in a time where, as I say, there was this pressure to homogenize society and to respond to the crisis of capitalism, to the crisis of globalization alongside the collapse of empires.
It was a little eerie reading the book at a moment when our government is deporting people en masse and conducting violent crackdowns. It just seems a little too familiar.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of, unfortunately, there are a lot of tragic parallels with the interwar period. And one of them is the fact that this is the times in which we live now is also a moment of deglobalization, where you see these projects to isolate states from a high level of integration, both commercial and political, to undo international institutions. In the interwar period, this was the case with the League of Nations, which had emerged after World War I as an institution that would foster international collaboration and solidarity between states. And eventually, as a result of the Wall Street crash and the financial crisis, also each of these states have to retreat into isolation and begin this first trade and tariffs war, then armament race, and then eventually this all leads to World War II. It's also a time in which politics moves from being, let's say, mild nationalist politics concerned with just making sure that certain ethnic groups are not discriminated or that the majority is not subject to minority pressure. From nationalist politics, it eventually deteriorates and degenerates into full fascism, and with that, all the abuses of power and the decline in the rule of law. It's a politics of, as we see in nowadays, of scapegoating of minorities for the sake of these political projects. So I think it's really a warning in a way. You see how history repeats itself. You see how also it degenerates very quickly and it slips out of control without necessarily those who are living in those times immediately understanding. And you see the ways in which people, for example, in the early 30s, relativize Hitler or say, well, fascism is not as bad as it looks. It's not as violent as it looks. And how when citizens realize that this is actually not going to end well, it's too late to do something about it.
A lot of the ferment of the time comes through in the book. Some well-to-do youth becoming socialists, but there's also a rising hostility to Jews. Gustav, the German businessman, who is a rather unappealing character, was upset by the Bolsheviks. You could see this kind of ferment in the personal lives of your ancestral family. And your family that you write about was of multiple and often uncertain nationality at a time of rising nationalism. So how did the family fit into this political environment?
Well, in a way, the violence that the family experienced in the past century was the result of exactly not having a clear answer to this question that became the dominant question directed to all groups that didn't fit very well, which was, where are you? What are you? Where do you belong? And because their lives had been so cosmopolitan and so enmeshed with each other, and because these new rising nation states were very hard to separate because they had been part of these cosmopolitan entities for such a long time, it was exactly those groups that then got caught up in the conflicts between nationalist fascists on the one hand, socialists and communists on the other, liberals. And each of these groups, a lot of my book is about the question of dignity and what does dignity mean in this time of extremes and how can individuals protect their dignity and stand up for it when there are so many conflicting projects. And a lot of it is really about how the politics of the interwar period puts pressure on individuals and how those like my family who are uncertain, who are constantly trying to find nuance in between the political clashes, are exactly the victims because they don't have clear answers. They don't have the black and white responses that the time seems to require.
The family seemed rather well off, and there's even a prime minister in the family. So what was the social class of this group?
Both my grandmother's case and my grandfather's case came from elite Ottoman families of Albanian background. But then in the family, everyone spoke French, as all aristocrats did in those days. And there was often also generational clash between the older generations of my great-grandfather, the prime minister, who was much more pragmatic, much more of a realist, who had been an Ottoman administrator himself, and then eventually became a prominent nationalist politician in the new Albanian nation state that emerged from the collapse of empire. My grandfather, the younger generation, were socialists who felt that it was not enough to democratize the empire. It was not enough to have your own independent state. You also have to think about certain social and cultural projects within the nation state. And a lot of it is also about how, in the case of my grandfather, how the clash between, for example, a socialist who was closer to the social democratic reformist tradition and his university friend, Enver Hoxha, who became eventually the leader of the Albanian communists and held power in Albania for almost a half a century, how this is a clash of generations of people who came from certain elite families who were then in charge of leading the new independent state and who had different visions on how this state had to develop under capitalist constraints on the one hand and in this clash with nationalism on the other.
I'm speaking with Lea Uppi, author of Indignity, just out from Farrar Straus. I'm curious how you would describe what you're up to in a formal sense in the book as a piece of literature. It's a mix of memoir, research project, a novel with an omniscient narrator privy to characters' inner thoughts. So yeah, how do you think about what you're doing when you're putting this together?
I think of it as a hybrid project. It's in part a family saga, in part a political history of Europe from the decline, from the collapse of the Ottoman Empire to the end of World War II and the rise of communism. It's a philosophical book that explores the different moral and political meanings of dignity in these times of upheaval. And the book really has two narrative voices. One is in the first person, describing my experience of going to the archive and trying to find the truth about my grandmother's life. But then when met with the uncertainty and the silences of the archive, retreats to the third person and tries to reimagine this life in a way that gives it the dignity with method and with a mechanism that is slightly different from that of factual history, the kind of factual history that the archive gives you and that appeals to literature and uses literary devices to try and give voice to these silences of the archive. And those parts of the book are written in a novelistic way that is inspired by the kinds of 19th century novels that I like, where, as you say, there is a third person narrator that then tries to convey the perspective of each of the different characters despite their differences.
And how much of what you write was derived from, say, conversations with your grandmother and other members of the family, and how much is fictionalized?
A lot of it is driven by my own personal recollections and stories of my grandmother. But then even the parts that are fictionalized are all also grounded on historical detail and historical investigation. So I didn't really invent anything in the sense that everything I say was true of some character who lived at some point at the time and down to the very minute detail. So if I say that, for example, a character was drinking from a glass that was held by Ataturk, the Turkish leader, at some point, that Ataturk really would have been drinking from this glass in this particular cafe that I describe, and it really looked the way I describe it. So all of it is based on archival sources from local history, from diplomatic documents, from newspapers of the period, from memoirs, from correspondence of people who lived there. And it's just that I think literature enables you to give life to all these fragments that you find in the empire, in the archive, in a way in which you wouldn't be able to reconstruct it if you were just setting out to reconstruct the life of a person that you know. And so that's where the project of the granddaughter who is reflecting on her grandmother's life and the project of a writer who tries to reflect on what it means to lead this life in this particular historical context, subject to these forces, are merged, but also trying to formally preserve some distinction by using these two different narrative voices.
Your grandmother seems like a very intriguing character. How would you describe her?
She was a woman who suffered very much during her life because she was born to this aristocratic, wealthy family and then came to Albania, met my grandfather, who eventually ended up a political prisoner after World War II. So she had a life of ups and downs, made of crises and of really sometimes struggles to survive. She was completely isolated from her family because the rest of her family were in Greece. She was on her own at the age of 26, became a single mother because her husband was put in prison, and she was deported to the countryside and was doing menial works for which she'd never been prepared. And the one thing that struck me, I was very close to her, I grew up with her, often turned to her for advice when Albania transitioned from being a communist state to being a capitalist one. Whenever I asked her how she coped with all these difficulties of her life, she would say that she tried to preserve her dignity. And that's partly why the book is about the idea of dignity, because it's about the statements of this person that I often thought of as a very dignified person who tried to turn her story into a life lesson in a way for me, in trying to say, look, you don't have to compromise every time, and you need to think about the principle behind what you're doing, and you need to think about the consequences it has for other people. So that's why the book is also a reflection on this theme of dignity, which I very much associated with her.
Yeah, I want to talk a bit more about dignity in a moment, but Albania, I know next to nothing about that country. One of the things I was surprised to learn was the role of Italy as a colonial master and Mussolini's occupation of it. How did Albania emerge as a country? And then this period, what did it do to its emergence or identity as a nation?
Albania had always been a distinct group from other countries, from other groups in the Balkans, let's say, because it had a distinctive language, which is Albanian. And it was also mostly a Muslim country. So for a while, the fate of Albania was tied to the fate of the Ottoman Empire, and even the people who were championing for greater freedom from the Ottoman Empire, the Albanian elites of the 19th century, for a while thought that they could remain in some ways connected to the Ottoman Empire, so with more regional autonomy, but not necessarily independent. And then when the Ottoman Empire collapsed, Albania became an independent state. But the territorial integrity was often under pressure. And so, for example, in the year in which my grandmother was born in 1918, even though Albania had been independent for a few years since 1912, which is when declared independence from the Ottoman Empire, it was attacked from the north by Yugoslavia, from the south by Greece, from Italy and Austro-Hungary have had different interests in the country. So it was a country whose territorial integrity throughout the first part of the 20th century was at stake. And in many ways, that's also the reason why communism, a group that came to power after the end of World War II, took this very particular, very isolationist features, very different from the other communists of the region, because it was a project that was trying to combine the principles of Marxism-Leninism, which is how they come to power, but also with this defense of territorial integrity via nationalism. And so it became a country that combined often a very strong nationalism that was required for survival, with these commitments to a very, very different kind of theory, which was communism.
And then with the Sino-Soviet split, Albania took a side.
In a way, it's an interesting country because it's always at the mercy of these geopolitical splits. And it was the last defender of Stalinism in Europe, even when everybody else, including the Soviet Union, had broken with the Stalinist tradition. That was the point at which Albania split with the Soviet Union, became an ally of China for a while, China under Mao, and so went through the Cultural Revolution, and then eventually became completely isolated when China also modernized. And in fact, communism in Albania fell in 1990, a year after all the rest of the former Soviet bloc. And it had left the Warsaw Treaty in 1968, for example. So it always had a very distinctive kind of communism and a very strange relationship with all the empires that surrounded it.
Then what was the period of transition like? I know you wrote about that in your previous book. The transition out of communism was pretty rocky, wasn't it?
It was a very difficult period for Albania. There was a lot of migration to Italy and Greece primarily, which were the neighbors, but also to other countries. It was a time of what was called then shock therapy. So these neoliberal reforms that were coercively imposed on a number of post-communist states, including Albania, which led to high unemployment, social crisis, and privatization of all the state enterprises and scarcity within. So it experienced all the shocks of the 90s that are now only becoming more and more discussed in the international Western media. You could really live that firsthand. I mean, I remember I grew up in Durrës, which was a seaside city, and I remembered how it went almost overnight from being very isolated, a place where you could only watch Italian television in secret and look at the Adriatic and know that Italy was on the other side, but also know that you could never go there, to a city that became primarily a city of immigrants because most of his youth had left to go to Italy. Suddenly there were, you know, drugs and smuggling and there was sex trafficking. And so all the horrors of the 90s, I lived firsthand, and now we begin to talk about these issues.
What does it feel like to go back now? I mean, it must be very different, but it's certainly not exactly the peak of prosperity either, is it?
Well, I mean, it's very different. It's changed a lot. It's much more modernized. It's much less isolated. You can see many more tourists every year. You could see much more high-end development, luxury development, including Jared Kushner, who bought a small island. So you can really see the capitalist development in the country, but it's still a place of high inequality and social exclusion, and where there's a lot of brain drain, lots of young people leave the country. So yeah, it's not exactly a paradise. On the other hand, it's no different from a number of other countries that continue to be described as countries in transition with this paradigm of development, you know, from unfreedom to freedom, when in fact, also in the West, you don't really see this anymore, because I feel that if there is a transition, it's in the opposite direction. It's more from the West becoming East than from the East becoming West.
Yeah. Convergence. I remember when I was studying economics in college way back in the 70s, we used to talk about convergence of capitalism and socialism, but it seems to be converging in a much less appealing way at the moment.
Well, yeah, converging on authoritarianism, absolutely.
Yeah. What did the people in Albania make of your researches? Did you seem like a little odd for your interest, or how did they take it?
Well, I mean, it really depends. I think it depends on the generation. For many Albanians, especially with my first book with Free, the story of Free was the story of their lives. And so there wasn't really anything new. But then if you were Albanian second generation migrants, for example, and their parents had never spoken about what it was like to live under communism, this was everyone liked it and found it interesting and found it a source of information about lives that had not been spoken of. I think with the second book, it's a little bit different because the period is different. But then the interesting thing is a lot of it covers Albania during World War II. And interestingly, after communism and after the fall of communism, historiography about World War II is the one thing that hasn't really changed in Albania. There's very much a narrative of the war where you have the communists are the good guys, the fascists are the bad guys. And the story of Albania is isolated from the story of the rest of Europe and the geopolitics of the rest of Europe. And what my book tries to do is to place that back in the global geopolitical map and try to explain how the shifts that you experience in Albania at the time are really a reflection of the major shifts that are experienced also in the rest of the world. And so the forces are very similar.
Towards the end of the book, you say the system, the communist system, ruined your grandmother's life, but not yours. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I was a child, 11, 12, when communism fell. And of course, under communism, children don't really have political views. And I think communism was most repressive when it came to political freedom and to censorship. So I don't really remember censorship because I didn't have political opinions at the time. I remember a very safe, secure society where children were being looked after and where the party and Enver Hoxha protected you, and where freedom was what Albania had, unlike other countries. We felt very sorry for people in the US, for example, who had to live with this imperialist system. We felt very sorry for people in the Soviet Union who had to live with revisionist system. So I had somehow endorsed this state propaganda, and that's a lot of the story of Free, is about how you can live in a communist dictatorship without ever thinking that you're unfree if you come from a particular perspective. So as a child, I don't really have any memories of trauma. It was only when my family told me after communism fell that they came from a particular background and they had suffered during communism, in part as a result of that, because they belonged to the old elites, because they had different views of economic development and so on, that this disconnect between the world in which I had grown and the world in which my family, in particular my grandmother, had grown, became visible to me. But that was after, so communism was gone. So all my memories of that period are actually nice memories.
And I should say that despite your experience with Albanian communism and then its aftermath, you didn't come to the West and turn into a reactionary cheerleader for the Western system either.
Well, also because the fall of communism didn't necessarily make capitalism good. I mean, it seems to be that, yes, communism failed and there were issues of unfreedom, in particular when it came to political expression and censorship and dissent and freedom of movement and freedom of an association and so on. But then I think capitalism also oppresses in a different way. It oppresses in a more, maybe not in this vertical way in which communism, at least state communism, oppressed, but in a more horizontal way that makes oppression, the result of the things that we do because we consume certain things or because we buy certain things or because we contribute to a system that, I don't know, uses our data in a certain way. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the oppression under capitalism is any less pervasive or any less concerning than the oppression under socialism. And certainly I don't think that the end of the Cold War and the end of communism meant that this other system was the winner or was the right one or was a morally justifiable one. So I think in my work critically about both of these systems, and I try to think about what could be an alternative that reflects on both of these experiences of the past and comes up with a model that is able to actually integrate the best of both worlds and to exclude the worst of both worlds.
And finally, dignity. The title is Dignity in the Negative, but the word dignity is repeated throughout the book. What is your conception of dignity, and how does it relate to the story you tell in the book? And I have to say, we can't share your conclusions because that would be a spoiler, so I'm deliberately avoiding your final discoveries. But yeah, muse on dignity for us.
Well, for me, dignity is connected to what my grandmother suggested was the free will. And so this ability that only humans have to reflect on what they're doing and to reflect on their decisions in a way that doesn't mean simply following your inclinations or your passions or your instincts, but is able to actually rise above them and ask, are they justifiable or not? And what implications do they have for other people? And I think this capacity that we have for moral agency is what gives us dignity. But it remains an ideal in the world in which most of what we see is actually indignity, is the effort to undermine this moral capacity that we all have. And that's why there is a lot of discussion on what dignity is, both in the person and in the collective, both in different political projects in the book. But the word indignity only occurs once in the very final sentence. And it says that the book tries to offer an account of indignity defied through imagination, precisely because of the way it combines fact and fiction and history and literature to reflect on the truth, not just from a factual perspective, but also from this moral perspective that tries to think about the agency of humans.
That was Leah Uppi. Her book, Indignity, is just out from Farrar Straus. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some music of disillusionment. This, David Bowie's with the hippie culture of the 1960s, Memory of a Free Festival. Till next week, bye.
The children of the summer's end gathered in the dampened grass. We played our songs and felt the London sky resting on our hands. It was God's land. It was ragged and naive. It was heaven. Touch, we touched the very soul of holding each and every life. We claimed the very source of joy ran through. It didn't, but it seemed that way. I kissed a lot of people that day.